Drive D.
Okay. Well, good day, you students. Nice to have you again here. We were last time talking about research concerning prematurity and the rigidity of the mother. And let's play a little bit with some concepts we have discussed so far. So in this example, to be born too early, prematuritas, is considered a risk factor. We have talked about many risk factors. We talked about, for instance, cerebral palsy. That also could be seen as a risk factor. And aggression, in the sense of all those physiological indices we have discussed in the very past, could be considered to be a risk factor. A risk factor for what? Well, that the development of people who are carrying this risk factor is not going to become optimal. And you have learned also two other concepts. A necessary risk factor. Well, in that case, you hardly can speak about a risk factor, I would say, because necessary means... Now I made a mistake. When it comes to sufficient, when it is a sufficient factor, then having that factor is enough. Having those genes is enough to develop the problem. When we talk about a necessary factor, then it means that the necessary factor is, let's say, embedded in a whole list of related go factors. And then we have the mechanism, the risk mechanism. Well, in case of aggression, it meant that the risk mechanism could be the quality of the environment. If you remember it well, then the combination of a poor environment together with all kinds of physiological indices related to aggression is enlarging the risk for developing aggression and all kinds of problem behavior. So here we discussed the risk mechanism, the rigidity of the mother. It could have been anything else. The quality of the environment, social economical status, etc., etc. We choose for rigidity because many children who are born premature also show signs of ADHD. And ADHD in turn means rapid changing with respect to all kinds of situations. So the more rigid you are as a caretaker, in this case the mother, then the more problems you have with reading, understanding what a child wants. So that was the reason to investigate the relation between prematurity and rigidity of the mothers. And we were interested in motor functioning and the child's IQ as a function of years. So this was again a longitudinal study. And Here you see the term birth wave. So that made it also possible to compare, let's say, a prematurity-related index, birth wave, in relation to an external factor, maternal rigidity, and what happens over time. And this was the last slide that I showed to you. And the real message is that the rigidity of the mother, it is correlated with the IQ in terms of minus 0.52, which is, well, quite moderate, if not large, correlation. So the range is 10 points, IQ points, in the child. So the more rigid the mother is, the less is the IQ with a range of 10 points. Another issue we have not discussed last time, and that is one of the reasons why I start again with this study, was that as a starter, so after 1 year, the child-related factors like birth weight and things like that was predicting the outcome much more than the rigidity of the mother. And then later on, when the child becomes older, then much more environmental factors become involved. And that is, I would say, a rule of thumb, that as a starter, those problem-related factors are correlating high with developmental indices, but when children becomes older, then environmental factors like rigidity of the mother will have a bigger role. Okay, for those who are interested in these types of studies, Butcher, Philippa Butcher, she's the first author, and I probably am the last one. And here you read the title of the journal, Child Psychiatry and Human Development, volume number, page numbers. Okay, so we have discussed, it was a long journey, I would say. We have discussed for hours the interplay between nature and nurture over time. And we talked about risk factors and risk mechanisms. I hope that you can now play with those terms. And that longitudinal research is a powerful tool to investigate these relations. And maybe we could say that the early years are very important in the development, and the early years are forever. That is one important saying in the field. And even, or not even, but Sigmund Freud, he already understood how important the early life is with respect to the development. And one of his sayings is, the child is psychologically the father of the man. So that what has been experienced in the past is having a high, a big role in the development of people. So now, let's turn to the issue of what we have discussed so far. We have a birth. We have a fetal state. think about those children and the mothers are using alcohol. Think about, well, let's say ADHD that even a factor such as experience stress of the mother, the pregnant mother, is determining the outcome. And we have infants, we have school aged children, and we have adolescents. So the idea is that when something is taking place here, something negative, or here, that it may influence the outcome. So now, one of the crucial questions is it really so that things that are happening here will have a continuously negative outcome as a function of age? And the answer is, well, very little. You can read it here, that the correlations between tests over as a function of age, so if you correlate scores you have gathered here and you compared it with scores obtained when children are older, the same children, then it is not so that the child with a high score here will also have a high score here. No, it could be high score here, low score here, or low score here, high score there. The correlations between tests are low across the lifespan. And that makes it so difficult to make a prognosis. We also have discussed that earlier, that a prognosis, that is what parents, what caretakers want from the expert. What can we expect when children are getting older? Is their situation become better? Is their situation becomes worse over time? Well, these are essential questions. And so we need longitudinal studies. And I have said earlier that the amount of longitudinal studies, well, it depends a little bit on the subject. But when it comes to cerebral palsy and the quality of brain structures here, then there are maybe in the total worldwide 15 to 20 studies available. Well, that's not much if you had to have to compare that amount with studies on ADHD or autism or whatsoever. So the correlations are low across the lifespan, and the big question is why? Well, there are all kinds of reasons. Think about the plasticity of the central nervous system. Well, plasticity is another word for reaction. And we know already that the brain is reacting towards all kinds of environmental pressure in a good way, in a bad way. And when people are interested as such in the term plasticity of the central nervous system, then you could read publications realized by Rosenzweig, who was one of those pioneers. So the response, the brain response as such, I'm sorry, that is already an essential feature. Then we have the measurement error. Well, what is meant by that? It means that every age has its own tests. And you can't use a language test when children have the age of 1 year. so to speak. And every test has its own type of errors. And because we do not know all the relations between errors and noise and signal with respect to all those tests, yeah, it could be that overall the correlations between those test results is low. Then we have qualitative versus quantitative changes. A quantitative change, that is very easy to understand. It means that you start with very little, and as a function of age, you become better and better. That is a quantitative change. So when we have, let's say, an index of the quality of walking, then you may understand that when a child has the age of one, then the quality of walking is, let's say, scored by a 1 or 2 points. But when a child becomes older, then the walking is increasing, walking quality is increasing and increasing. So maybe it goes to 3 points, 4 points, 10 points, and we call that a quantitative change. So that is easy to understand. But what about a qualitative change? Well, think about those worms that becomes butterflies. A worm is not the exact word, but because my English is not my mother tongue, but you for sure will understand that there are certain worms, and at a certain moment they change into butterflies. So that means a qualitative change of everything. And you can imagine that development is full of all kinds of qualitative changes. So how to predict, let's say, the quality of flying of a butterfly? Yeah. When you are investigating the movements of those worms who later on becomes a butterfly. This is quite difficult to compare with the quantitative changes. So because development is full of qualitative changes, it is difficult to predict the outcome from one age towards another. In fact, also the idea about causality is quite simple. We are used at the causality between event A and event B is, let's say, a few seconds. But we have learned now, I hope, that when we talk about development, we all have all kinds of protective and risk factors. Think about, again, quality of environmental factors. When they are positive, then they may protect, they may buffer against all kinds of harmful factors. And we have talked about risk factors already. Then we have talked about growing into one's deficit. It means that talking about causality, well, there might be 20, 40 years between the origin of the problem and when it is shown, growing into the deficit. And erasing the tape is, in fact, the term opposite to going into the deficit. It means that development could be seen as a sequence of all kinds of tapes, and a tape is running, and then it comes to an end. Then go to another tape, and it might be that in the tape itself, with respect to a certain age, there is a problem, and that problem remains until we switch on a new tape. Erasing the tape, it goes a little bit close to qualitative changes. Yeah? So a problem exists in a narrow band of 1 or 2 or 3 years. And then in terms of development, a new tape is put on the system, and then you don't see it anymore back, the problem. It's like what parents tell us. Yeah, when he was a child, it was, the boy was extremely difficult to handle. And that could be the case, but then suddenly, spontaneously, the problems are disappearing. So the idea of causality is complex. And here are three. There are, of course, more things to say, but at least three phenomena which illustrate how complex the term causality in that sense is. Now, I already have talked about measurement error. You can't use the same tests when you investigate the lifespan. And the translation rules between tests meant for a certain age are lacking. And much more research has to be devoted to these issues. Okay, let's give an example of how to measure, for instance, attention in babies. Babyology. Okay? Here you see a baby, and it is seated in a comfortable chair, and in front of the baby there are three screens, and only this one, this is the starter of the experiment. So in fact we see three screens, and we are dealing here with the so-called looking task. Well, that is of course obvious, because children of this age, they can't do so much else than only looking. And when is the experiment starting? That is already a point you have to take into consideration when you are interested in testing very young children. What I try to say is that you can't simply say to such a child, well, look at the screen, look at the middle part. No. You have to wait. You have to wait until the child, by accident, is, let's say, looking to this screen. And then, first you have a fixation, you see, and now it comes. Let's say here we had the fixation, and then on the next moment, there is a stimulus presented at this part. So what is needed is that the child has to disengage the attention from this spot to that spot. And when children are, let's say, less than 10 days old, when they are fixating here, and when you are presenting an stimulus here, then they don't disengage and move the attention from here. No, they simply remain looking at this spot. But when children become older, so after 10 days, then the disengagement and the moving of attention and the engagement that they really start to look here is becoming better and better as a function of time, as a function of age. So children of 3 weeks old, they disengage and engage, and it takes a couple of seconds. And when they are, let's say, again a little bit older, then it is done in 1 second. Yeah? So those processes become more and more smooth. We continue with the experiment. So here was the stimulus. And the researcher has measured the time needed to move the attention to here. And here we have again the orienting spot, fixation spot, so to speak. Let us continue. The stimulus, the next stimulus, could have been presented here or here. Let's say that it is a 50-50 condition. And I have on purpose put the second stimulus again here. And now we are arrived with a very important concept in babyology, the inhibition of return. I will explain that to you. That when again the stimulus is presented at the same location, when you are, let's say, like a little bit developing autism, then you like this. The same location. People with autism, one characteristic when they become older, is, let's say, that they like sameness. Everything must be the same. So this is what research is showing, that when the stimulus is presenting at the same location, then especially those who are developing autism, they might be more interested in the old location, so to speak, the same location, whereas babies who are developing them optimally, they prefer new stimuli. And that is what we call inhibition of return. So in normal populations, there could be a tendency to inhibit your moving attention to the old locations. You prefer that the stimulus is now presented here, whereas in, let's say, groups of children who are developing autism, it could be just the other way around. This is simply the outcome of just a few of those developmental studies on children at risk for autism. I'm very sure that when you start to go to the library, that there is now a set of studies, and you could write a nice manuscript. What is the state of the art? Is it still so that people with autism, when they were very young, that they show no inhibition of return in comparison to people who are normally developing? So again, we have the fetal state, we have the birth, we again started to talk about a few tools that could be help in the identification of babies who are at risk of developing autism, and at the same time it must be seen how these measures, which are getting in infancy, holds when people are getting older. And still we are in the middle of discussing why correlations between tests as a function of age are correlating low. Why? Now, yeah, think about Emily Werner, who was formulating protective and risk factors. She was one of the pioneers in identifying, describing protective and risk factors. She was investigating in the 50s, in the 60s of the last century, on one of those islands in the Pacific, the developmental outcome of thousands of children. And what she found was that when it comes to risk factors, that there were children who had at least 3 to 4 risk factors on their shoulders, but the outcome was nevertheless okay. So she was in, using the term vulnerable but invincible for those type of children. They are vulnerable but invincible. So in spite of the risk factors, they were, the outcome was okay in those children. Think about buffering against all kinds of risk factors. And what were in the days of Emily Werner some important indices of protective factors against risk factors? Well, for instance, IQ level of the children, but also a good health. And when it comes to, let's say, personality characteristics, it seems that even humor, making jokes, that it could be seen as a protective factor. So these were the days of Emily Werner, one of the first who was taking into consideration protective against risk factors. She was introducing the term vulnerable but invincible, and that even people with 4 risk factors had an okay outcome in life. And today we have neurobiology. What are the mechanisms? What are the physiological mechanisms that makes it possible to buffer against, let's say, risk factors? So the phenomena are the same, but let's say the way to investigate those factors are different now, 60, 70 years later. In any case, the transactional model is the best, that there is an ongoing change, This is structure. It might be that there is a problem here. It has an effect on the environment. This has an effect in turn, again, on the structure and again on the environment. Transactional models, that's the future. And it must be said that much of our longitudinal research, it is too non-dynamic. One or two measures, and then we are using all kinds of statistics which are not taking the interactions into account. Now we are coming close to the issue of nature nurture, in that sense, that Pennington, which is also an outstanding neuropsychologist, that he claims that distinctions between functional and organic is misleading and incorrect. So again, we are close to slide number 3 of our first lecture, where we formulated all kinds of layers of explanations, the social level, the psychological level, etc., etc. And that all those layers are interacting in one way towards the other. And here you see that Pennington is, in a sense, referring to that conceptualization, because he said that functional, which is more on top, the organic, which is more the bottom of that chain of approaches, that the differentiation is misleading. And that also holds for, let's say, old ideas that, for instance, functional disorders call for behavioral treatments, and that organic disorders call for biological interventions. This is old-fashioned. It is old-fashioned to say that, well, when we talk about ADHD, those children need a behavioral treatment, and when the problem behavior is more severe, then we need more biological intervention. For instance, drugs. As if drugs are only interfering on the organic system. No, that's not the case. When we talk about behavioral treatments, then it may alter also the functional organization of the brain, maybe even the structural organization of the brain. We went in our lecture so far to talk about, for instance, the influence of loneliness, isolation on the brain structure. Do you remember? So whether it is an outside factor or an inside factor, it's all the same in that sense. And as long as we are using those distinct levels, then we will never approach to universal theory of psychopathology. So once again, this is the old idea. It goes from etiology, causation, to brain development, to behavior. And this is the much more modern point of view. We have etiology, causation, we have brain development, we have behavior, but there is also a way back. There is even a way back to here, because everything is, in that sense, interacting. I need a break of 5 minutes. Let's be back, and then we start to talk about autism. Thank you very much. And the diagnosis is based on weak social interaction starting early in life. And we have now and then already made some lines in our discussion concerning autism, that they have problems in going to new stimuli. That is what the baby research is suggesting. And all these cognitive skills are, of course, needed in order to develop social interactions. I have already talked it over that the environment caretakers are claiming towards those who are working in the field. I have the idea that my child is simply looking through me. We have discussed in one of our former lectures some EEG research. Do you remember that for babies who are normally developing, that their brain response is different when they have to process faces against objects, and that the brain response in those who are developing autism, that there's hardly a difference in brain response whether those individuals have to process objects or faces. So it starts early in life. It might start even before the child is born, and there is research going on these matters. 70% of about 70% of the people who are developing autism show signs or have mental retardation. And here we have an old differentiation, namely people with Asperger. We may also call it high functioning autism. So those individuals have a higher IQ than 70. And we have children who don't fulfill all the clinical requirements to get the diagnosis of autism. And we called it pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. It doesn't mean that these children are better off than the children here who are fulfilling the requirements, the clinical requirements to get the diagnosis, because when you don't fulfill all the requirements, but some, it might be that severe that still the quality of life is disputable in that sense. Nowadays, experts believe that it is better to talk about autism spectrum disorder. Yeah, so this is a little bit old-fashioned connotation, but nevertheless, you will see it in the literature, these types of differentiations. One of the theories, which is quite essential in autism, is the theory of mind. It means mind reading. It means that you have an understanding of not only your own feelings, but also of the feelings of other people, that you can walk into their shoes. Mind reading. So it means that there is little understanding of social cues. And a traditional test and probably you all have heard of it, is the Sally test. And then there is all kinds of research going where people who have autism, to what extent they are able to detect emotions from faces. Or how do you look to the face of another person? I mean, the best way to remember a face, to look at a face, is if you take into account that triangle. Do you remember when we were talking about these issues? Exploring the face of another person. Then there are all kinds of tests. For instance, that you have a booklet and you show it to the child. And the booklet is full of all kinds of pictures. For instance, picture one, a child is biking. Picture number two, the child is falling from his bike on the pedestrian area. And it is hurting its knee. And then the question is, which emotion is now mirrored by the child? Is it crying? Is it laughing? Well, the correct answer is probably crying or being sad. When you have problems with walking in the shoes of another person, then you may give a wrong answer. All these tests are in development in the laboratories to get more grip of what is lacking according to the theory of mind in those people. Of course, you always have to control for IQ. And if you control, then it becomes less simple to say, well, those people with autism have a lack of theory of mind. It is not that simple. And also, motivation is involved. It could be the case that people with autism are simply, and especially those with higher IQ levels, that they have a lack of motivation for being involved in feelings of other people. The other thing is that most of the laymen, they think that autism is only, let's say, present in youngsters. No, youngsters are getting older. And maybe that during the last 20 years, there is now also a move towards investigating older people with autism. What is their problem? Well, I always give the example of, let's say, a person who is highly intelligent, who is, let's say, an engineer, and who is very much able to do his work. But he likes to be isolated. He is not interested in all kinds of parties which are organized during work. No, he likes to continue working. And nevertheless, he doesn't, in spite of the fact that he's working hard, he hardly is making errors. We come to that subject of error making or less error making in, we will discuss it during my next course. So they are very reliable, they are working, and nevertheless they have little understanding of the social environment. They might not lie, for instance. Do you know that lying means at least that you understand the environment? It is a high concept, high cognitive concept to lie. And it is not out of the question that people who are normally developing, that they lie quite a lot during daytime. But not the people with autism, because they can't oversee their behavior, what the consequences are. For instance, when you ask me the question, what do you think about your boss? I would say, as a person who has not developed autism, well, I like my boss. I would be crazy to say that I don't like him. No, I like his humor. And maybe also his deodorant, do you understand me? But a person with autism, he could say the truth, because he doesn't understand the consequences of his or her behavior. So to make a long story short in this respect, the theory of mind is an important skill of us to proceed in our complex environment, in our society. And when you have problems with these skills, then you are in trouble when you are a child, but also when you are an adult. There is a third movement when it comes to autism, and that is, of course, early identification. So once again, adults, what happens with adults with respect to autism? And the second new movement is how to identify autism in very young children in order to optimize the treatments which are available. I would like to proceed with a person and his laboratory somewhere in the south of Germany, Michael Tomasello. And he did a lot of research on monkeys, how they develop a theory of mind. In people who are developing autism, and what happens with respect to the normal development of the theory of mind. Tomasello. And to use the first umbrella term, he is very much interested in understanding of the psychological state of others. And he compared it again with chimpanzees, with children with autism, normal development. And he comes to the conclusion that sharing psychological states with others, that is, I would say, the main sentence in Tomasello's laboratory findings, sharing the psychological states with others. And then, where do these unique human abilities come from? How do we create a society as we have created around us? And this is, I would say, very much of interest. This is one of his studies in which he compared children who were 6 months of age, 9 months of age, 12 months, and 18 months of age. And practically all his research is observation in game-like situations. And in this research, this is simply one of those examples. You see a psychologist probably, and here a child, and this is the caretaker. And you see that the psychologist has a marble in her hand. And the child has a theory of mind. Do you know why? Because in spite of the age, the child knows, because of his theory of mind, that she is going to give that marble to him or her. And you can see that because he is reaching the hand. Now the experiment is as follows, that it concerns in this case the relation between unwilling or unable. What does it mean, unwilling? It means that she is going to give the marble, but halfway the marble drops out of her hand. And the question was whether the child is able to differentiate whether this was on purpose, unwilling, or unable, so that it was an accident. Well, this is very much of importance when it comes to the development of a theory of mind. Are you able to recognize whether the other person is, in a sense, teasing you, that she is simply dropping the marble out of the hand because that is what she wants, or that it is a mistake, unable, it's a failure, it's an accident. And the outcome is that when children are 9 months of age or older, they became impatient more, impatient in the unwilling than in the unable condition. So that means that maybe some children started even to cry. This is a way to investigate an important differentiation in developing the theory of mind, unwilling against unable. And children who have the average age of 6 months, they didn't show this difference. Maybe you can't see it, but here we have a chimpanzee, and this is a person who takes care of the chimpanzee, and he has here some food in his hand. And it is the same procedure. Halfway, the food drops out of the hand, and is the monkey able to differentiate between unwilling or unable? And the answer is, according to these studies, that chimpanzees are able to differentiate between unwilling and unable, because when it is an unwilling situation, then those animals become frustrated. They start to knock on this window, for instance. So like older infants, chimpanzees showed more frustration in the unwilling than in the unable condition. much of interest theme is between goals versus intentions. What is the difference between a goal and an intention? Maybe I go directly to the next slide to make this a little bit more clear to you. Here we have the laboratory condition where one of the experimenters sitting here on a chair is using its nose to push on this button, this white button. And when you push, then a lamp is turning on. Why is he using the nose? It is because in this condition, she can't use the hands because there is a towel. You see that? She can't use the hands. So this is why she wants to switch on, switch off the light. This is why she uses the nose. In this condition, the same person is still using the nose, although the hands are free. So here we have the condition that the person is intending to use the nose. So the target is here an intention to use the nose, and here it is simply a more difficult picture to interpret because she had to use the nose. So the target is switching on the light, but here we have the condition where the subject was intending to use the nose. Okay. Now the question is, when people who are developing autism, young children, are they mimicking this situation or are they mimicking this situation? And it was found out that young children from 14 months old, they were copying the unusual action more when the subject had to choose to use it than when she had to use it. So there is a preference for those who are watching those situations to copy this situation. They are able to differentiate. So the question is, how do people with autism and how do monkeys, how are they what kind of performance are they carrying out? And in one of the study findings, it was so that the chimpanzees did not show this effect. They copied the demonstrator equally often in both conditions. But in a recent study, the same results were found. So here, again, you see science in action, that when we talk about chimpanzees, then some studies are pointing into the direction they can see the differentiation between goals and intention, and in another study, they can't see it. So it has to be seen, and I have given you some sources, some papers in which you can read it if you are interested in this type of results. So when it comes to goals and intentions. Their normal chimpanzees may understand other goals, but not intentions, although in some conditions, uncultured chimpanzees may understand intentions. And children with autism, this is very much of interest, may understand goals, but not intentions. So this differentiation is very much of interest because understanding goals is loading on cognitive abilities. So a cognitive understanding. Intentions is by definition more in the domain of emotions, sharing of emotions, and children with autism may not understand this. I have seen a very interesting video once in the city of Rotterdam. And you must imagine that a normal child was tested by a psychologist, and the psychologist was using a book with an iron thing in it, so an old-fashioned iron thing. So there are holes in the paper, and you put those iron things in these holes of paper, and then you can close it. And the psychologist was acting, pretending, when she was closing the book, that her finger was hurted by means of that iron system inside that booklet. And she said, "Oh, I hurt it myself." And a normal child, a boy of, let's say, 1.5, 2 years of age, he jumped out of the chair and he went to the psychologist and started to say, "Oh, my poor dear," and this and that. So he was sharing, he understood the situation, but there was more going on. He was sharing his feelings with that psychologist. And then the same psychologist was testing a child with autism. And then again, at a certain moment after testing, she was closing the book. And again, she was pretending that she was hurting her finger. And do you know what that boy with autism was saying? "Tja, then you have to look out more carefully. You have to be more careful. When you have those iron things inside the booklet, yeah, then indeed, you may hurt yourself." So it showed that the child with autism was able, from a cognitive point of view, to understand the pain, to understand the whole setup of the situation. But when it comes to sharing that feeling, then the child was not demonstrating that. Well, years earlier, Tomasello was already able to differentiate this. He discovered this, that children with autism may understand others' goals, but not the intentions. So here you see already the power of doing good behavioral observations in monkeys, in children who are developing autism, etc., etc. Here is another type of research on the theory of mind. So here you see the young child, here the caretaker, here an assistant psychologist, and here in front of the child you see all kinds of toys. And she is also a psychologist. And before she left the room, all these toys were here except that one. So she went away out of the room and she was putting here a new toy. And then she returned and then she is pointing very enthusiastically towards the new toy, but it is a little bit ambitious. And she said, oh, is this a new toy? And then the idea is that whether this youngster has developed a theory of mind, that he is able to understand that she is meaning that toy. And that can be checked because he is saying, give it to me. And then he's going to give that new toy. So this is another aspect of a theory of mind that in spite of the age or from a certain age of on, the child is understanding that she is meaning this toy. It needs a theory of mind. So Tomasello proposes that the crucial difference between human cognition and that of other species is the ability to participate with others in collaborative activities with shared goals and intentions. And Tomasello is calling this shared intentionality. Shared intentionality. And it consists out of two components. The cognitive understanding, and also infants and people with autism and monkeys are achieving this level understanding of other psychological status, but this seems to be, according to Tomasello, unique for humans who are developing, okay, motivation to share psychological states with others. So that is a unique skill of our humans, according to this researcher, sharing psychological states with others. Motivation to share. There is joint emotions, joint attention, joint interest and understanding. And there is evidence of collaboration, joint attention, intentions, mutual knowledge. Motivation to share in infants. Early proto-conversations. Sharing emotions. Well, look at this picture. The mother. It's belly to belly. And the child likes it. Children with autism, most of them, don't like this at all. They don't like to be touched in that way. And it has to be seen whether this also takes place in monkeys. Joint attention. Well, reading a book aloud. The child is actively participating and is even pointing and is even saying to probably the father here, hey, read this again, please. So they are sharing attention. And it is probably possible when children achieve the age of 9 months, sharing attention and interest. Playing together. That is, of course, also a skill that you are not isolated. Know that you are actively involved in what is happening here. So she is moving this block, maybe to that direction. The child is moving it back. They are playing. He knows or she knows what to do. They are playing. Motivation to share in infants. What about this type of behavior? That you are pointing into a certain direction. That you are helping another person. Pointing, that shows up as a skill around 12 months of age. Helping. So, what we have here, early proto-conversation, so belly to belly. Now, is it taking place in autism? Many children don't like it, as I said earlier. In chimpanzees, it has to be seen, so it is no with a question mark. Joint attention, no, of course not, because you need monkeys are not reading aloud in a book. Here, declarative gestures, no. Social imitation, no. In chimpanzees, neither in people with autism, according to Tomasello. Communication as collaboration. To interpret others' communication, especially non-verbal communication, we need a shared content, context, or common ground, which makes it necessary. What about communication? Do you know that about 70% of our behavior is non-verbal? So verbal skills are necessary, but also the non-verbal skills, the gesture making. And I can tell you that many people with autism, they hardly have any differentiation in their voice. It is very monotonous, and they hardly use gestures to make themselves more understandable. This is an experimental setup. Here you see a child, and here the mother probably. And this is the psychologist. And she has tested the child. And then she is searching for some papers or some objects. She's pretending that she doesn't know where the papers are. And here we have a normal child. He has a good theory of mind. So he understands that she is looking for some objects, for some papers to continue. And he helps her. He is pointing into that direction. And then she will say, "Ach ja, thank you very much. I have not noticed that." Now the question is, do monkeys do the same? So infants are pointing to help the adult, by informing her about the location of the objects she was looking for. Apes are doing the same, but only when the object is belonging to them. So it is not helping, it is not collaboration as such. No, the object belongs, in fact, to the monkey. And when that is the case, he is willing to point to a direction. But again, it is not because of helping somebody else, it is not cooperation. No, it is only to satisfy the own situation. That is a huge differentiation. So in the normal situation, so in people who are not developing helping behavior, they are able, when you are 18 months or older, you are able to cooperate with an adult to achieve a joint goal. And chimpanzees and children with autism, they showed far less coordination of roles and fewer or no communicative requests for the partner's continued participation. So here you see again the difference in terms of joint goals, joint feelings, etc. That is where the normal developing infant and people with autism and chimpanzees are going into different directions. So in summary, in addition to understanding of other psychological states, infants who are not developing autism, they have the motivation to share psychological state with others, and they have the ability to cooperate and coordinate intentions with others. Chimpanzees and children with autism do not show evidence of these additional motivations or abilities. So let's now concentrate on this, because this is, let's say, the foundation of our society. It is based on sharing. It is based on the ability to cooperate and to coordinate intentions. According to this researcher, Tomasello, primates are competitive, only when it concerns them or when it concerns their tribe. You may see it maybe a little bit wider. They may show certain abilities into direction, but humans, in addition, are cooperative and they evolve skills and motivations of collaboration. Now, when individuals or groups, when they are able to collaborate more actively, then there is a selective advantage. Because of that collaboration, there is more food, there is a better shelter, there is a better protection. And here you can see that, according to Tomasello, this is a biological explanation of the social, we call it social biology. And as a result of that sharing and collaboration, language became possible, because that is handy when you want to collaborate, when there is a common language and when there is other cultural learning and creating possibilities. So here we have a little bit the ideas of Tomasello, that here we have the basic understanding of psychological states, emotions, goals, perceptions. We have discussed this. We have discussed the milestones of intentions, attention, knowledge, beliefs. Then there is a motivation to share, and that leads to proto-conversations, when the child has developed about 3 months of age, shared goals, 9 months, and here we start with collaboration. So it could be that chimpanzees and children with autism, that they are very individualistic, and that children who are normally developing, they are more collaborative. So that is the differentiation made by Tomasello. Is everybody agreeing?
I have something to say, of course, if I may. I know we're out of time, but I just don't see I don't understand the value of establishing that people with autism are developmentally at the same level of a monkey. I find it so controversial.
Well, that is, of course, a very good criticism. Not everybody agrees with him. I don't know whether he is explaining whether children with autism are, let's say, at the same level of chimpanzees. That was not my intention. My intention was to give you insight a little bit in all kinds of...
Oh, Professor, I wasn't talking about your intention. I love your lectures and I enjoy them very much. I just, I'm talking about this Tomasello dude and Carpenter, the ones that did the study. I just don't understand the value of the study what I understand by this study is that people with autism are developmentally at the same level as a monkey, and yeah, so what's the value on that?
I even have a doubt whether this is the claim made by Tomasello as such. He is simply comparing those three groups in terms of developmental stage and the fact that children with autism go hand in hand with respect to some developmental stages of a theory of mind. I don't think that he is claiming that children with autism have the same level of theory of mind as chimpanzees have. I think that would be too easy as such. That would be too easy. I myself, I would like to continue if you don't mind. By saying that people in his field don't all agree with him. And one aspect of dispute when it comes to doing behavioral observations, in this case in chimpanzees, is the issue of who are you observing? Are those monkeys living in laboratories, or are they living in their natural habitat, outside in the jungle? Because there are people, biologists, behavioral biologists, and they are doing research on chimpanzees living in their own natural condition. And many of those behavioral biologists, they claim, well, when you look at wolves, for instance, when they are hungry, then they collaborate. There are some wolves who are hunting the target, so they are running behind the target. And there are also wolves who are, let's say, surrounding the animal, hunted. And at a certain moment, that animal is that tired that, well, it can be used as food. The point is, those animals are collaborating to a certain extent. The answer of Tomasella to that issue is yes. He could not deny that are animals living in the wild who are collaborating. But when, let's say, put in other terms, when some of those animals who have the duty to hunt behind the target, they are ill. Is it possible to replace those animals? And Tomasello is saying that our collaboration is to such a high extent that when some people are ill in the collaboration, then other people can replace them. So this is, of course, not the final answer of the biological behavioral observation techniques. No, I only show this, and for people who are interested, it could serve as a tool. All in all, when we go back to part of these experimental setups I have shown, in fact, it is a part of making the diagnosis, playing together with children. What happens then is part of the diagnosis. So you must imagine that in one condition, for instance, you have a balloon. And when you hit the balloon, it goes upwards. Is the child then ignoring the balloon, or is it surprised and maybe starts to laugh even? Then also making designs together belongs to the diagnosis. That, for instance, the experimenter starts to design part of a house, only the front, and then the child has to continue. Well, when we're talking about a normal developing child, he will continue it designing that house. For instance, he decides then the roof, or starts to design the chimney, starts to design a window. But the child who is developing autism, they are not designing in collaboration. So that was another reason to show you this type of research.
I understand why you show the research. I just don't understand the study and the research itself. Okay, now we've established that that's a scene. So what? What is the value of that? What can you do with that? I don't understand. I mean, do you know what I mean, Professor?
No, yeah. When I show you an overhead sheet with the term theory of mind, and when I say it is the ability to walk in others' shoes, do you then understand the theory of mind?
I actually have a lot of problems with that too, but with the whole concept of theory of mind and the whole spectrum of autism, and I know it's super late and we could be talking forever and I don't want to take your time and everybody else, but I have a lot of problems understanding that the spectrum of autism is so big, because it's impossible to diagnose properly with such a big spectrum. And also I find that the theory of mind is also a concept that I have a hard time understanding, because if you pathologize it, you're ignoring simply individual differences. But maybe this is not the time now to talk about that, because I don't want to steal more of your time.
No, we have now to stop for this day. But yes. I consider all your remarks of great value, because what you read in the mainstream books are terms like theory of mind. If you start to think about what is actually meant by theory of mind, well, then it is not so easy to define it, and you all always may question the objectivation of the theory of mind using those tests we have just discussed. Of course, it is, yes. I would say, a real scientific approach to question the what is called the ecological validity of a psychological test. Does it really cover the meaning? And what is the meaning of the theory of mind? What is the precise definition?
Yeah, no, exactly, especially the diagnostic tools. Well, anyways, I could go on forever, Professor, so I just go away.
Okay, we continue tomorrow. I know that so far, only two students have contacted me and asked whether the title of the paper was okay and the subject. And so maybe because tomorrow it's the last lecture, we'll talk about aggression. And well, that is it for writing a paper. So maybe there are more students who want to contact me and ask whether they are on the right way. Well, see you tomorrow then. Bye-bye.